D.C. Emergency 911 operator 6752. Do you need police, fire, or ambulance?
Immediately. I'm in an ambulance.
What's wrong, ma'am?
We had someone that was in our house, evidently, and they stabbed somebody.
Okay, somebody's inside the house now?
I don't know. We heard.
Are they bleeding? You see someone bleeding?
Someone's bleeding in our house.
Okay, where are they bleeding from?
I think in the stomach.
In the stomach? Is he conscious? Calm down for me. I'm going to send some help, okay? Female or male?
It's a male. He's a friend of ours. He's spending the night with us.
Okay, and who was the person that stabbed him? Do you know? Is he conscious?
We need an ambulance.
Ma'am, listen to me.
He's not conscious.
He's not conscious at all.
No. We need someone right now.
According to Google Maps, during rush hour on a Wednesday night, the best route home to Oakton, Virginia from the offices at Radio Free Asia, which are located at 2025 M Street in Washington, D.C., is to take I-66 West. At most, it takes 40 minutes. To get from Radio Free Asia to 1509 Swan Street in D.C.'s DuPont Circle neighborhood, well, you take L and 16th Street, and depending on traffic, it takes between 5 to 15 minutes. Much shorter. It accounts for why the victim chose to stay there that night, supposedly among friends. The 911 call you heard was placed on the evening of August 2, 2006. A D.C. attorney named Robert Wone was dead, found stabbed to death in a Tony DuPont Circle townhouse. It was the home of three men, one of whom had been the deceased's friend since college. After the police came, 1509's three residents swore that an intruder had broken in and murdered Robert. The cops thought that one or more of them had. Three stab wounds, three suspects. Who was telling the truth? This is Wicked Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing awful things. Welcome back. I'm your host, Jay Harvey. This episode's about a bizarre murder that took place in Washington, D.C. in August of 2006. A successful young attorney was staying overnight at the home of a friend and his partner, and their partner. What was as simple as a man crashing for the night at a buddy's house so he didn't have to drive home that night became a murder mystery that still doesn't have a solution to this day. And why does it read so bizarrely? Well, Robert Wone, a by all accounts heterosexual man, staying with three openly gay men, appeared to have been sexually assaulted before being murdered, and possibly drugged prior to that. The knife that was found that was supposedly used to kill Wone didn't match his wounds, but a knife missing from the kitchen would have. You might have noticed that the 911 call I played for you was a little odd. The demeanor of the house's residents the night of the murder was reportedly terribly blasé, considering that they were claiming someone had broken into their home and killed a friend of theirs that night. And the scene of the crime? The cops firmly believed that it had been tampered with to cover up for the killer. Speaking of the cops, their investigation moved especially slow and had a few hitches and some mistakes. So slow, in fact, that the victim's wife had to issue a public appeal to the suspects to urge them to come forward with any information they might have had to try and solve her husband's brutal murder. There was a trial, but, spoiler alert, justice has still not been done in Robert Wone's name, and no one is paid for his murder. At least not with their freedom. This is episode 15, What the Hell Happened to Robert Wone? Part 1. Yeah, this is the first multi-part episode of Wicked Gay since the very first one that was about Donald Harvey. But I swear there were no horrific details about catheters in this one. There was just too much information for this one episode. So let's first get into the players involved and what reportedly happened the night of the murder. In part 2, we'll get into the investigation and everything that happened that's taken place up until today. Robert Eric Wone died at the very young age of 32. He was from New York City, a fourth-generation Chinese-American and the oldest of three boys. He attended the College of William & Mary as a Monroe Scholar and majored in public policy. He was heavily involved in student government, and that's how he met and befriended a man named Joseph Price. It was Price's townhouse that he would be found murdered in. Wone was a good man, concerned about the world and his fellow citizens. In college, he helped revive the 13 Club, which was an organization that did anonymous good deeds around campus. Wone was awarded the school's Algernon Sidney Sullivan Award at graduation, which is given to students who, quote, excelled in characteristics of heart, mind, and helpfulness towards others. He went to law school at the University of Pennsylvania, graduating cum laude in 1999, and he passed the New York State Bar, and for a year he clerked for a federal judge in the Eastern District of Virginia. Wone joined a law firm in D.C. in 2000, and his work focused on employment and commercial real estate law. He met his future wife, Catherine, at a conference in Philadelphia, and they were married in June of 2003. The Wones were active in various community organizations, and Robert served on many committees and boards, mostly having to do with Asian American culture and advancement, as well as groups and endeavors related to the legal industry. This was in addition to his mentoring law school students. Less than 2 weeks after his death, he was to have been made the president of the Asian Pan American Bar Association. In the summer of 2006, Robert Wone had just left a law firm that he was at to become the general counsel for Radio Free Asia, which is a U.S. government-funded, non-profit international broadcasting corporation based in D.C. Its mission is to provide accurate and timely news and information to Asian countries whose governments prohibit access to a free press. According to witness testimony, sometime around July 29, 2006, Robert Wone decided he wanted to stay late in the city to meet the employees who worked the night shift at Radio Free Asia. Remember, he had just started working there. He decided he wanted to combine the meet and greet with a continuing legal education course he wanted to take that was being held that night. After being told by a female friend that he couldn't stay at her place that night, she must have felt pretty guilty after that went down, he emailed his friend Joseph, Joe Price, to ask if it would be okay if he crashed at the townhouse that night, August 2nd. Joe says yes, so Robert Wone says he'll be there at 11 p.m. Catherine Wone was aware of her husband's plans. As I mentioned previously, Joe Price's townhouse was at 1509 Swan Street in DuPont Circle, which is the gay section of D.C. He lived there with his partner, Victor Zaborski, and his other partner, whose name then was Dylan Ward. We'll get into that arrangement in a second. Let's meet Joe Price, who was 35 years old at the time of Robert Wone's murder. Joseph Joe Price earned his undergrad degree in public policy from the College of William & Mary and graduated in 1993. It was there that he had first met Robert Wone, where they both served in student government, and the two formed a lasting friendship. And it wasn't just a casual, hey Bob, friendship. Joe and his partner Victor Zaborski attended Robert and Catherine's wedding in June of 2003. In 2004, Joe, Victor, and their kinky third wheel Dylan Ward hosted the Wones at the townhouse for Robert's 30th birthday, which would be the scene of his murder 2 years later. Joe Price continued his studies at the University of Virginia Law School, later serving a clerkship for a U.S. District Court judge for the Western District of Virginia. He was heavily involved in gay rights advocacy, having helped found and serve from 2002 to 2006 as general counsel for Equality Virginia, a gay rights advocacy group. This was while he was working for D.C. law firm Arendt Fox, becoming a partner there in 2006. He specialized in intellectual property litigation as well as trademark and copyright disputes. He also had a pro bono practice going on. While awaiting trial, he ended up taking a leave of absence from Arendt Fox, then quitting altogether. He'd resided in D.C. for over a decade at the time of the murder, most of that time in a committed partnership with Victor Zaborski. They were living together in both D.C. and then later, after the trial, in Miami. By all accounts, including their own, Price was also in another relationship with Dylan Ward, whose background we'll get to in a minute. The three were active in the gay rights community, hosting brunches and parties at the townhouse. From my research, I learned that the three men considered themselves a family, but it was more like two relationships under one roof as opposed to your usual throuple situation. Joe and Victor were partners, and Joe and Dylan had their own thing. By all accounts, Dylan Ward is or was heavy into BDSM. Wait until you hit a list of paraphernalia that was found on the scene. Woo! And he was reportedly into a dominant, submissive relationship with Joe, with Dylan being the boss. So there was a lot going on under that roof, even before someone was brutally murdered. Hey, if it worked for them. At the time of the murder, Ward and Price had their thing going for 5 years. In his police interrogation, Victor Zaborski noted that he did consider Dylan Ward family, but that he wasn't an equal in his relationship with Joe Price, but that they were working towards that. It sounds like it was kind of complex. Price's partner, Victor Zaborski, and I keep wanting to say Zbornak whenever I see it. It's a Z, and it's so Golden Girls to me, but I'll stop doing that because why would I sell you Golden Girls with this sordid story? Price's partner, Victor Zaborski, was in marketing. He was one of the guys that came up with the Got Milk campaign. Remember that enormously popular marketing campaign? with the milk mustaches on the back of like every comic book I read in the 90s. The dude won awards for it. He was that guy. I couldn't find much about Victor's background, but there was an interesting USA Today article from 2004 that revealed that Victor and Joe had fathered two children with a lesbian couple who were friends of theirs, with the second child, which Victor fathered, being born in April of 2004. Joe fathered the first. So, and Joe and Victor were said to be very much part of their kids' lives. That was as of that article. Who knows what happened after Body started turning up at Daddy's guest room. Our third featured player is Dylan Ward. He was born May 24th, 1970, the son of a cardiologist and the oldest of five siblings. All of them reside in Tacoma, Washington. He graduated summa cum laude from Georgetown University with a BS in Foreign Service in 1992. In 95, he graduated from the Culinary Institute of America with an Associate of Culinary Arts degree. In 2003, he earned a Master's in Children's Literature from Simmons College here in Boston. Ward has written and edited numerous children's books, several of which have received awards. After graduating from Simmons, he relocated to Washington, D.C., where he rented the basement apartment in the Capitol Hill home of Joe Price and Victor Zaborsky, and entered into an intimate situation with at least Price. When Price and Zaborsky sold that place, Ward relocated with them to their new home in 1509 Swan Street. Ward also worked at Equality Virginia as the development director. That's the gay rights advocacy organization where Price was the director. He was known for breaking all of the organization's records when it came to fundraising. In 2006, he graduated from the Potomac Institute for Massage Therapy and obtained his license to practice as a masseuse, or masseur, excuse me, in the District of Columbia. In 2007, he traveled to Thailand, where he completed a six-week training course in Thai massage, obtaining his certification to practice Thai massage here in the States. As I mentioned, Dylan Ward was involved in the three-way relationship with Price and Zaborsky. Price and Zaborsky shared the master bedroom and were registered domestic partners. Ward occupied a second bedroom and was involved in a personal, intimate relationship with Price. The nature of the relationship with Price, as I said, included a dominant-submissive component, with Ward playing the dominant role and Price being the submissive. And what about the house? What about 1509 Swan Street where this all went down? Well, from the description, I want to live there. Well, when there's not dead people tragically laying around. A 1.2 million three-story townhouse. It had a basement unit rented by a tenant of Joe and Victor's, one Sarah Morgan, who wasn't home the night of the murder. The first floor had a living room with a 16-stair staircase upstairs, which at the time of the crime was uncarpeted wood. There was a dining area, a kitchen, and a deadbolt door to an outdoor patio enclosed by an 8-foot fence and a locked gate. The second floor had Ward's bedroom at the top of the stairs, a bathroom, a study/guest room, which is at the front of the house looking out over Swan Street. And immediately outside that room, stairs to a third-floor master bedroom suite, which Price and Zaborsky shared, when I assume Joe Price wasn't in a cage or whatever in Dylan's room. I'm not judging. Get your kink on. I'm just assuming. Yeah, I know. Ask you, me. At the time of the murder, the house had an alarm system which would, quote, chime every time the front or rear doors were opened. So, the night of the murder. Here's a timeline, which I was able to pull from a post on the Unsolved Mysteries subreddit on Reddit. Strap in. Wednesday, August 2nd, 2006, 8:45 a.m. After they take D.C. subway, aka the Metro, into the city together, Robert and Kathy Wone say their goodbyes on Connecticut Avenue. That's the last time she'll see him alive. 9:30 p.m. that night, Wone calls Catherine saying he just left his CLE class and is on his way back to work to meet the night shift employees. Later, the General Consul of Radio Free Europe, who attended the same class as Wone, confirms that he attended and that they had subway together and they had walked back to the office together. Ugh, imagine that's your last meal. Even worse, wasn't Pedo Bear Jared the spokesgross back then? Even worse. 9:40 p.m., Wone is back at the office, meets with the night shift staff. 10:24 p.m., Wone calls Joe Price, presumably to say that he'll be leaving soon. Travel time to the Swan Street townhouse is a minimum of 8 minutes by taxi. Price told investigators that they had just finished dinner and they were cleaning up an overflowing shower in the master bedroom. Victor Zaborsky recalls the call coming in not long after 10:15. He said that he was in bed upstairs watching Project Runway when Robert Wollin arrived. Okay, can I get up for you a little bit here? Project Run back then in that time was awesome. That's when Project Runway was incredible and Heidi and Tim were still in charge and running things, at least back then. And they went to like Bryant Park and stuff, and it was like Fashion Week and it was very suspenseful. And that was the season, I had to look this up, but I recall this, that Jeffrey Sebelius won, but I couldn't recall him at all, but I did recall Keith Michael. Sorry, no, Michael Knight, who had that amazing, like, fuchsia-colored pantsuit. And then Laura Bennett was, like, the classy, like, older, ginger Audrey Hepburn chick who had that, like, that nut sack. No, sorry, that, that came out wrong. The sack. It was a sack dress. She made a dress out of a sack that said, like, nuts on it. Sorry. I should really edit that. And Uli was one of the contestants, and Milan was. It was a good season, but I don't recall Jeffrey Sebelius, though, who was the one winner. Oh, I missed that show. That show was so good. It was really good. And I normally hate reality shows. But for Project Runway, you needed talent, and they created something. They weren't just, like, being slutty in hot tubs and being mean to each other and flaunting their wealth. Like, I hate those ones. The Real Housewives franchise is trash. Trash. I'm not going to say if you watch that you're trash, but you're adjacent to trash. Ugh. It's like the worst of humanity. It really is. It's everything we should aspire not to be. Remember the episode, and I don't watch it. I've seen clips, though. I'm being honest. The clip of the lady who comes out with the sunglasses and she goes, 25,000. She's saying that her sunglasses cost 25,000. Our country is falling the fuck apart, and this bitch has $25,000 sunglasses on. She should have been drawn and quartered. I'm sorry, I don't know how this became a diatribe against reality television. Let's get back to the murder. Murder. And yeah, that's how gay I am. When I heard that Victor Zaborsky was, that's what he told the cops he was watching the night of the murder. I had to look up what season it was, who won, what dresses. Yeah, Prodron. Gay. 10:32 p.m. is the earliest possible time Wollin could have arrived at the townhouse. According to Joe Price and Dylan Ward, they have some water in the kitchen and chat with Wollin. According to Price and Ward, everyone goes to their rooms around this time. Victor Zaborsky said that Price watched the end of Project Runway with him, meaning he came upstairs around 10:50. Dylan Ward says he took a sleeping pill and read a book for a bit, then fell asleep. He says he heard Robert Wollin taking a shower in the bathroom down the hall. It was a hot night, remember, it's August, and Price had asked everyone to keep their doors closed to maximize the air conditioning. Price said he watches about 5 or 10 minutes of Spike TV, remember Spike TV? But Zaborsky wanted to go to sleep, so he said he turned it off and they went to sleep between 11:05 and 11:10. 11:05 to 11:07 p.m., police found that Wollin's BlackBerry, remember those, had two emails drafted, one to Wollin's wife Kathy saying that he had just showered and was about to go to sleep, another confirming a work lunch the next day. Although it's noted that the timestamp on these could have been altered. The emails weren't sent. Remember when I said the investigation wasn't, shall we say, perfect? Well, the police failed to image or fingerprint the device before returning it to Radio Free Asia, who wiped it. Sometime between 11 and 11:35 p.m., the next-door neighbor, a man named William Thomas, heard what he referred to as a desperation scream from 1509 Swan Street. This is while he also hears his wife watching reporter Maureen Bunyan on TV reporting the news. Later during the trial, the defense attorneys argued that Thomas mistook Bunyan for ABC Nightline reporter Vicky Mabry, who had a segment on from 11:45 to 11:52 p.m. It was also later determined that that desperation scream was Victor Zaborsky's. Price and Zaborsky both claim they are awakened by the door alarm chime at some point, but are unsure of the time. They assume by the chime that it's their basement tenant, Sarah Morgan, returning, even though she had told them she wouldn't be home that night. And now, let me play for you the 911 call in its entirety. Please note that I did edit it for when there were extended silences. When all you could hear was the 911 operator, whose pronunciation of blood, I adore, and she's typing, and Victor is breathing heavy. So I edited those parts out, but listen. And I should point out, whether or not, or whatever his intention was, this call can be disturbing. There's some emotion there, and it's disturbing, just so you know ahead of time.
DC Emergency 911, operator 6752. Do you need police, fire, or ambulance?
Immediately. I'm in an ambulance.
What's wrong, ma'am?
We had someone that was in our house, evidently, and they stabbed somebody.
Okay, somebody's inside the house now?
I don't know. We heard.
Are they bleeding? You see someone bleeding?
Someone's bleeding in our house.
Okay, where are they bleeding from?
I think in the stomach.
In the stomach? Is he conscious? Calm down for me. I'm going to send some help, okay? Female or male?
It's a male. He's a friend of ours. He's spending the night with us.
Okay, and who was the person that stabbed him? Do you know? Is he conscious?
We need an ambulance.
Ma'am, listen to me.
He's not conscious.
He's not conscious at all?
No. We need someone right now.
Is he breathing? Listen to me. Calm down. I'm going to help you, okay? Is he breathing?
I'm upstairs, and he's downstairs. I don't know.
Okay, who's downstairs with him?
My partner is downstairs with him right now. He told me to go upstairs and call the police immediately. I just went to the stairs.
Okay, who's the person? Okay, I'm sending paramedics and the police. Okay, who's the person that stabbed him?
I don't know. We think it's somebody with an intruder in the house. We heard the chime at the door.
And it's 15, ma'am, calm down, 1509 Swan Street Northwest, am I correct?
Yes, it is.
The person that stabbed him, is he still in the home?
I don't know.
We got help and route, okay?
Pardon me?
We have help and route.
Thank you. They're here.
They are en route to you now. I'm sending the police and the paramedics, okay, to assist. Okay, what I need you to do is go downstairs, okay? The place wherever he was stabbed at, I need you to get a dry cloth, okay? And just apply pressure to that area. If he was wherever he was stabbed at on his body, I need you to take a towel downstairs while you're waiting for the paramedics to arrive and just apply pressure. Even if the rag or towel is saturated with blood, just get another towel and put it on top, but never lift the first towel off the area. Hold it on. Once it gets filled up with blood, just put another towel on top of that and just apply pressure until the paramedics arrive.
Apply pressure until the paramedics on the ledge.
Yeah.
With the heart.
In the heart?
Yes. In the center of his chest.
Okay. Is he breathing?
Is he breathing?
We have help him right now, okay? You don't know who it was?
I have no idea. Don't touch.
Okay, is he breathing?
He's breathing, but he needs help now.
Okay, we have help and route, ma'am, okay? We do have help and route. Okay, just go down there and try to tell your husband or your other the other half to just try to keep him calm and talk to him, okay? Keep him calm and talk to him until someone gets there.
Okay.
And at the same time, get a dry cloth and just hold it right there in the area.
My partner's holding the...
Okay.
Holding it on him.
Okay, and once it gets saturated with blood, tell him get another one. Go get another towel so you can apply it on top of that one once it gets filled up with blood.
Okay,
we need you to apply pressure on that area.
He is applying pressure right now.
Okay, just hold it there until the paramedics get there. They should be pulling up any moment. If they're already en route to your location, you don't know who did this.
We have no idea who did this.
Is the door open so they can get in?
We don't know how they got in.
Okay, well, I'm asking you now, is the door open so the paramedics can get in once they get here?
What? Sorry, what were you saying?
Is the door open so they can get in? Is the door open so the paramedics can get in the home?
I'm going to go down.
Is this a private home apartment?
It's a home.
It's a home. It's 1509 Swan Street Northwest.
The person had one of our knives.
The person that stabbed him ran out the door with a knife?
I think so.
Okay, anybody get any type of description of the person that came in the home?
I have no idea. We have no description. We heard the chime, and we heard the scream from our friend.
Okay.
And so we came running downstairs. We ran in.
So you both was upstairs and your friend was downstairs?
Yes.
You heard the door open and then you heard the scream?
I didn't hear the door open until after the scream, and then we ran down the stairs and we have an alarm. And so the chime went off.
Okay.
Is the ambulance, please, we really need the ambulance.
Okay, they're in route now, ma'am. Go to the door. They should be pulling up any moment, okay?
I'm afraid to go downstairs.
Okay, the person who's downstairs was the person that was assaulted.
No, we're on the second floor.
Okay, so somebody need to go downstairs and open the door for the paramedics. You're not sure if that person's still in the home or not.
I have no idea.
Okay, we have paramedics in route, okay?
What time is it?
What time is it at the moment?
Yes.
23:54. It's 11:54, ma'am.
11:54.
Yes.
I mean...
I'll stay on the line with you. I will stay on the line until somebody gets here, okay? I won't hang up.
We need them right now. I'm not hanging up, but we need help now.
Okay, they're en route, ma'am. They are en route. Let me know when you hear the paramedics. Can you look out the window and see if you hear them coming?
I'm looking out the window, and I see nothing. I see nobody.
Okay, it seemed like forever, but they are en route, ma'am. They're coming.
Here they are. Here they are.
They're there.
I'm going downstairs.
Okay. I'll stand in line with you till you open the door for the paramedics, okay?
Help us. Someone was stabbed. They're on our second floor.
Ma'am?
No, it's really an emergency. I mean, he may be. Please hurry.
Ma'am, it's gonna be okay.
Okay, a couple of things about that call. One, was I the only person who wanted to pop in and tell her that Victor, as far as I know, his pronouns are he and him? I don't know why I latched onto that. I understand her mistake, but it was gnawing at me. Two, I am not a sleuth by any stretch of the imagination. I can't tell you how many times I've lost my smartphone, only to realize it's on the roof of the car I'm driving. But here, there were some suspect things going on in that phone call. Like, where was he when he made it? Was he downstairs or upstairs? He's talking about the body like it's right there in front of him at some point, but then he says he's upstairs. He seems to indicate that there's someone in the room with him at certain pauses he makes, but no. And then he goes into how one of their knives was used, but when the 911 operator inquires further, he clams up. It's just, okay, I'll use a word that true crime authoress extraordinaire Anne Rule used, which she attributed to the cop she worked with. It was a word they would use when something in a case just didn't agree with them. Hinky. There's something hinky about that 911 call. At the end of it, when he loses his shit and the orgasmic banshee wails of terror begin, was that just fear and horror pouring out of the relief over the paramedics coming? Maybe hoping that they could save Robert's life still, so he's very emotionally upset? Or was that an outpouring of, oh fuck, we are in so much trouble, losing his shit, crying? Or was that some bad acting? Thoughts? Anyone? I really can only relay the story, but I do return to that word, hinky. Oh, and I nearly forgot. Remember the odd mention of Robert being stabbed in the heart? How did that medical determination come from the I Got Milk guy? Does he have training? Or was there so little blood or what? Robert Wone's body was found in the guest bedroom by the paramedics, lying on the mattress of the room's convertible love seat. The paramedics had arrived at 11:54 p.m., followed by the police. He'd been stabbed twice in the chest and once in the abdomen. At the scene, Joe Price initially told the cops that about 10 minutes after he heard the sound of the door chimes, which indicated that someone had entered the townhouse or exited, someone he assumed was his basement tenant, Sarah Morgan, he heard the sound of deep, guttural moaning. He and Zaborski went to investigate and heard another kind of low scream as they got to the top of the stairs. They descended and entered the guest room, which is at the foot of the stairs. And there was Wone on the convertible sofa bed, bleeding. When he saw that, Zaborski let out a scream of his own, apparently. That could have been the scream that the neighbors heard. So, Joe Price said that he went to Wone's aid and told Victor to go back upstairs and call 911. And at this point, Dylan Ward said, despite having taken a sleeping pill, he was awakened by all the ruckus and came out of his room. Price described him as looking like he had no fucking clue. A boning knife, supposedly from the kitchen butcher block, was lying on Wone's stomach, Joe said. He said he put the knife on an end table and lifted Robert Wone's gray William and Mary t-shirt, and there were 3 stab wounds in his torso. Price said he saw a lot of blood on his chest. Meanwhile, Victor Zaborski's upstairs calling 911. Then he said that he went back downstairs and watched as his partner Joe applied direct pressure to Wone's wounds with a dry towel. When the paramedics got there, they ushered Victor and Joe aside. Robert Warren was in gym shorts and a t-shirt, on his back, on top of the bed covers, his head on a pillow, his arms by his sides, dead. In his mouth was the night guard he routinely wore to prevent his teeth from grinding in his sleep. Beneath him, the comforter and sheets were neatly turned down to a 45-degree angle. His wallet and Movado watch were in plain view on the table at the foot of the bed. A crumpled white bath towel was on the floor nearby. On the end table to the right of the bed was a kitchen knife. Various sources said that there was no signs of a struggle in the room, and one of the paramedics said that at least one of the victim's wounds was big enough to fit your fingers into. Despite that, the paramedics said they saw hardly any blood on Woon's body or in the room, and there were only a few small blood stains on the sheets and pillow. One of the paramedics later said that it looked as if the body had been showered, redressed, and placed in the bed. And speaking of showering, according to the police affidavit, Price, Zaborski, and Ward were reportedly together in the living room while this was going on, all wearing crisp white robes and appearing as if they had just showered themselves. Robert Woon was taken to George Washington University Hospital, where he was pronounced dead at 12:24 a.m. on August 3rd. The paramedics later told the cops that they found the three residents' behavior to be unusually calm. I mean, not to mention the freshly showered, like, day spa robes they had on. No one was screaming or even helping to direct the paramedics at first. Now, this conflicts with how Victor Zaborski was acting on the phone, that anguished keening that we all heard. Did he collect his shit? Were the paramedics being judgy here? We've talked about this before, the idea that someone can already be tried and convicted by the cops and those in attendance by their response to trauma or lack of thereof, which to me seems like a slippery slope. On the other hand, these were the people who see people at their worst in life, I mean the paramedics and cops, and how they see how they react to the most horrific situations in their lives. So they would know how people act, right? It's stuff to ponder. Additional details began to come out about the evening. Separated by the detectives, the three men were driven to Anacostia, which is 6 miles away, in a fortress-like building that belongs to the D.C. Police Violent Crimes Branch. That's where they were interrogated well into Thursday morning, separately. And almost from the beginning, all three of the townhouse's residents blamed the crime on an intruder. Okay, here's a question. First, why in D.C., despite the murder rate going down a scotch from the year before, would they have an unlocked door to their million-dollar townhouse for this unseen intruder to access? There were no signs of a break-in. Well, blame Charlotte and her web. Dylan Ward told the cops that Joe Price had seen a spider on the patio light bulb earlier that evening. Remember, the rear door of the townhouse led from the kitchen to a patio. Joe later said that it was completely plausible that he neglected to lock the door when he came back in after checking the bulb. So a spider might have been responsible for this unseen dude coming in and murdering their friend. I'm going to pause here with the spider story, and I want to close this episode now, which is part one, with the very shocking revelations from the autopsy. This is what sealed the three men's fate in the eyes of the authorities and began an investigation that led to arrests and a trial. The 8-page post-mortem examination report was filed 2 weeks later. The medical examiner said she found two tiny spots from broken capillaries in Woon's right eye and left eyelid. Those were caused by the flow of unoxygenated blood in a person who was fighting for air. So, in this case, a victim of a strangulation or suffocation. She said, though, that the asphyxia event wasn't fatal. It wasn't what killed him. What killed him was the stabbing. The blade had pierced his heart, so it had pierced his heart, like Victor Zaborski said, his pancreas, and his right lung. These stab wounds tend to be irregularly shaped, which is a result of the victim writhing around trying not to get stabbed. But in this case, his three wounds were, quote, perfect slit-like defects. They were clean and symmetrical, which is very unusual, and there were no defensive cuts anywhere on him. Although he suffered no injuries consistent with a sexual attack, she did discover semen around his genitals and in his rectum. and the DNA showed that the semen was his own. So the cops concluded that he was sexually assaulted, but this examination said that he wasn't. But why? I mean, we can try to guess why. I mean, there's a lot that could have gone on. You know, things have, I don't know. I'm not a doctor or a medical examiner. Draw your own conclusions. The cops' conclusion was that he was raped and attacked and by the men in the house. And here's another weird detail. She said she counted 6 pre-mortem needle marks on his chest, right foot, and left hand, and several more on the left side of his neck. The medical examiner ran a standard battery of tests in his case, and the toxicology lab searched for alcohol, cocaine, barbiturates, opiates, and amphetamines. It looked for the date rape drug GHB. It checked for benzos, a class of sedatives that include at least 3 other date rape drugs. It looked for PCP, which is a hallucinogen, which makes you act insane. And the tests also would have found traces of ketamine, which is another common date rape drug. All the results were negative. So what the hell were the injection marks then? And just what the hell happened to Robert Wone? We'll get more into it in the next episode. My sources for part one include the website whomurderedrobertwone.com, Wikipedia, Reddit, and the Washington Post. Wicked Gay's theme is by Gino and the Goons. You can find them on Spotify and Facebook. Additional music by JB. Wicked Gay cover art by Paul Chapman. And additional sound engineering by the other Mr. Harvey. You can find Wicked Gay in all of your major podcatchers, including Apple, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you think Wicked Gay is worthy of consumption, please like, subscribe, and review to get it out there. Every little bit helps. And you can find Wicked Gay on the big 3 social media platforms. No, not TikTok. My booty dancing and comedic lip dubbing skills aren't up to snuff just yet. I mean Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you're curious about what the various freaks and geeks I'm drawing about every week look like, that's where you can find photos of them. Pics of our perpetrators under Wicked Gay Pod. So please join us next week for part 2 of What the Hell Happened to Robert Wone. You've been listening to Wicked Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing awful things.